Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Sunday, February 12th, 2012. This is episode 848. Enjoy. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And yes, my friends, it's time once again to talk about computers, the internet, lots about cell phones for sure, home theater, you bet, all the cool stuff that's changing the world around us. 8888, Ask Leo is the phone number. 888-827-5536. It's toll-free in the U.S., outside the U.S., still toll-free. Just use Skype out, and it because it's a toll-free number, it won't cost you anything. 8888, Ask Leo. Of course, very sad day yesterday. I got home after the show and saw the news about Whitney Houston and immediately tuned to CNN. And, you know, imagine my surprise. I guess, you know, part of the problem when you're a 24-hour news network, and you've got a big story like that with pretty much nothing to say, you need to fill. And Twitter sure helped them. It ended up, did you see that? I mean, it ended up being for about an hour and a half. Let's read what people are saying on Twitter. It's fascinating to see. Now, I'm going to, we're so sad to lose Whitney, and that needn't be said, of course. But this is the tech show, so the tech angle is kind of interesting. Not only that, even mainstream media now uses Twitter as a primary source. And the comments, you know, they were getting a lot of comments from other people in the industry on Twitter. It's become very clear that that's how people in the music business, at least, and I suspect in almost every field now, communicate with the outside world. They tweet. It's instantaneous, it's direct, it's brief. It's kind of everything you want. There's no PR firm in the middle, or in most cases not. Although a lot of artists, I know Madonna and I know other artists use PR firms to tweet for them. Nevertheless, it's roughly direct. Notice, though, and maybe you did see this, I didn't, that there it was a lot of Twitter and not so much Facebook. Now, if you go to your Facebook, it was all over Facebook in many ways. And in many ways, it was better on Facebook. There was more content. There were pictures. There was music. There were videos. Facebook, in many ways, was kind of for me, the place to go to mourn with friends. But the networks didn't talk much about Facebook, and I realized that's the difference between Facebook, and this is the thing that makes Facebook crazy. Twitter got all the press because Twitter's public. Facebook, you're not really sure, are you? Where would they go on Facebook? To the CNN page? Well, they wouldn't see much there, right? Because do they have many friends on the CNN page? Would they go to Don Brown's personal page? Well, you can't do that because now you're exposing publicly content that's intended privately. So when I show my Facebook page, I'm really showing stuff that I do it all the time because that's the only way I can think of to show Facebook stuff that people didn't intend the public. They intended it for me. And this, in a nutshell, is why Facebook keeps changing their privacy policy. They don't want that. They love the idea that you're going to put all this stuff on Facebook. They don't like it so much that it's private, that they can't use it. And I think there's some serious Twitter envy. I think that that's part of the reason Facebook keeps changing their permissions to be more and more public. They want you to post publicly on Facebook, not privately. I think that's that in a nutshell. I realize as I'm watching this, Twitter's getting all the press. And that's of course. That's because Twitter's public by default. So all those celebrities might have posted on Facebook. In fact, I suspect some of them did on their Facebook pages. but only their friends could see it or their subscribers. Oh, notice they have now this subscription feature that's very much like Twitter. Very interesting. Antonio B2408 asks in the chat room, does CNN still use holograms? I haven't seen it since the election night 2008. Remember they had the 3D reporter? CNN is a little enamored, I think, of the geeky stuff. Maybe over enamored of the geeky stuff. Well, they want to be hip. Everybody wants to be hip. And those of us who've been using technology for years, we're already hip. We already know. So I talked yesterday a little bit about my new cell phone. I carry every cell phone under the sun. I have a Samsung Focus S Windows phone that I like. Looking forward to getting the new Nokia Lumia 900 Windows phone. I have an iPhone 4S, of course, and I use that a lot. I have been using that almost entirely because I like Siri so much. I like I have a Galaxy Nexus. That's the Google phone with ice cream sandwich. I'm not a huge fan of ice cream sandwich. In fact, my general advice to people was to get the Galaxy S2 instead. It's not on Verizon, unfortunately. On Verizon, my recommendation for an Android phone, if you don't want to get the iPhone, and for a lot of people, the iPhone's the right choice. On Verizon, you might want to look at the Razer Max, which is coming out, which you've seen the ads probably for. Has something like 15 hours talk time. It's a smartphone that you don't have to charge every night. But my favorite right now is this Galaxy Note that's coming out a week from today on AT&T. It's basically it's a Samsung. It's kind of like if you've seen the Galaxy S2, it's very much like that, except it's a little bigger, 5.3 inch screen. It's ginormous. It's huge. and it's beautiful. It's a really beautiful screen. I've been very happy with it. It's I call it a phablet. It's half tablet, half phone. You don't want to hold it up to your ear, especially if you have a small head or small. And I wouldn't recommend it for small hands because if you have small hands, you may not be able to use it in one-handed mode. But when you browse things like that, it's 1280 by 720. It's very high resolution. So it's really like using a desktop computer for a browser. It's kind of amazing to have a phone. And so thin and so light. So thin and so light that you don't really feel like it's such a big phone. I can carry it in my pocket, and I do. But one of the things that had wowed, there were two things that wowed me about the iPhone 4S and I was using it. One was the 8-megapixel camera, which was very good. The camera on the Samsung Galaxy S and on this Galaxy Note is 8 megapixels, and I would say just as good. It's a great camera. In some ways better. There's some kind of features that I like that the iPhone lacks. The other thing was I liked Siri. And all the Samsung phones now come with something called Vlingo, which is a third-party program. It's kind of like Siri. You double-tap the home button, and Vlingo launches. I probably have it turned, the audio turned all the way down, so let me turn it up here. And Vlingo launches. And when it does, you can do anything you can do with Siri, and then some. It doesn't do natural language. Call Jennifer at home. It doesn't do natural language. It does talk to you, though. Multiple contact matches found. Oh, I had to save the last name. So you could send texts. You could send emails. Unlike Siri, you can open any application. I can say, listen to Whitney Houston, and it'll start playing Whitney Houston music. I can say things I can't do on Siri on the iPhone 4S. For instance, I can tweet. I can say, Twitter update, or I think it's Twitter update. Now, that's where it's a little different than Siri. It's not what we call natural language. Siri understands, they call it natural language. Siri understands a variety of commands. You don't have to do it exactly right each time. But this Vlingo is a little bit more syntax limited. You have to know how to say it. You have to know how to tweet. But if once you'd learn that, it's not so hard. I am very impressed by this. I think this is the phone of the hour, and I mean hour, because there's always new ones. The Samsung Galaxy Note. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up right after this.
This one goes out to all the iPhone 4S users. get to know ya.
You see that the Flaming Lips did a song with Siri?
I'll give you an answer. Day or night.
Everybody's using Siri. So anyway, this lingo on this Galaxy Note, and I think other Galaxy phones, is as good, I would say, is as good as Siri is right now. And maybe Siri will get better. Maybe this will get better. Right now, I would say it's competitive. And so I'm looking at this phone thinking, this is a great phone in every respect, if you don't mind, if you want a big phone, this Galaxy Note, out in Sunday. And then I see that Apple's suing to keep it out of the country. Oh, really? Oh, interesting. You don't like that, huh? Now, Apple's been losing in court on these. A German court has rejected another Apple patent bid on the Galaxy Tab. I just think that... You remember that Steve Jobs was furious about Google and Android. Actually, it wasn't the Galaxy Note they were suing about. It was Galaxy Nexus, wasn't it? Apple asked for a preliminary injunction against selling the Galaxy Nexus smartphone in the U.S., claiming it violates patents, including the slide-to-unlock patent. Apple claims ownership of slide-to-unlock. No one can do that. It's kind of sad, to be honest. I understand that Apple has the right to protect its patents, and I'm sure that they feel that this is just doing what they need to do to protect their intellectual property. I'm sure this has nothing to do with the fact that Galaxy is the number two smartphone maker. I'm sure it has nothing to do with the fact that Android is now larger in some respects in terms of sales and use than Apple. And the iPhone. I'm sure it has nothing to do with any of that, that they just merely want to protect their stuff. Nevertheless, come on. Make a better phone. So there's some thought, and I noticed all over the net, people are thinking maybe one of the reasons Apple's worried about this is because of the iPhone 5. Apple has an iPhone 5 coming out. We're pretty sure this year. We don't know. In past years, the iPhone comes out in the summer. Last year came out in the fall. They skipped their summer release and came out in the fall with a 4S. In normal course of events, Apple does kind of this every other year cycle. They do major upgrades every other year. Makes sense. In the U.S., contracts are 2 years with a cell phone company, so people don't generally upgrade but every 2 years. So if you had an iPhone 4, you wouldn't feel too bad about the iPhone 4S. Looks the same, has a few extra features, faster processor. Better camera, Siri, but nothing to, like, cry about. So it means it's time for the iPhone 5. This is for people who bought the iPhone 4, for the iPhone 5 to be another bigger step up. And there's speculation about bigger screens, higher res screens. Well, I'm not sure what they'll do in iPhone 5. I'm pretty sure they'll go LTE, the new 4G network available from both AT&T and Verizon. I'm pretty sure that'll be in it. I don't know, though, if they'll go with a bigger screen. I have a feeling they won't. And in some ways, I think that's going to make the distinction between Apple and Samsung even more stark. I'm sure the success of the Galaxy Note, and they've already sold 1 million overseas, just now coming to the U.S. Next Sunday. I'm sure the success of this will stimulate others like Motorola and LG to make bigger screen phones. I think Apple might be stuck with their 3.5-inch screen. They don't want to fragment the market too much, and that might end up being a disadvantage. You know, I'm just happy there's choice. And I guess that's really the point I'm making. I'm not against the iPhone. Love the iPhone. These days I'm carrying the Galaxy Note. Love it. I like it that I have a choice. And no matter what carrier you're on now, you have a choice. And that's the good news. Let's go to the phones. Mark's in Tustin, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Mark.
Hey. Actually, I have two questions. One's about the Apple iPhone and why I switched the phone from a 3 to a 4. The Apple Store changed it out for me. I have stuff now on the iPhone's calendar that won't transfer to my iCal on my iMac. But if I put, say, something on the same date and time, it'll go down to the iPhone. I can delete it on the iPhone. It'll delete back, but there's just some orphan stuff that's on the iPhone calendar that won't seem to transfer up. And I'm wondering, is there some way to shake, jiggle it, pray, cross fingers, something to get it to come back up. Because there's more than a few of them, so I hate to have to re-enter
it. You got me. It should just work.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I stopped using iCal syncing because I use so many phones that I started using Google Calendar. And it works just fine with desktop Apple, both the standard Apple calendar and address book, iCal and the address book, will sync with your Google calendar and contacts. iPhone also will automatically sync, two-way sync with Google. And so I just ended up using Google for everything. There's another advantage to that is that when you get a different phone, you just log into your Google account and it automatically works. So it works across all platforms and so forth. So
one more quick question.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of, for my computer, IBM computer customers, I'm going to do a website that just says how to buy a computer so they don't have to call me about all these little things, how to run Sandboxy, how to do backups, literally
good.
Videos and tutorials.
Good.
So, but the question I have is, I hear, should I use, you've talked about a USB mic, a turbo something, or the Heil 20s or PR40s.
For, you mean for podcasting?
Yeah, for podcasting and doing, and so what should I shoot the video in? What should I use the mic?
Ah, I see what you're saying. Is it just going to be the one time, or are you going to do this more?
Well, obviously, you've been doing security now for 6 years, thinking any day now you'll stop. It ain't gonna ever happen, is it?
Yeah, we thought we'd only do one or two. Security still is an issue. So the only reason I ask is, do you want to make a big investment in a microphone? I think for under $200, a good choice is, first of all, it's easier to use a USB-interfaced microphone. You don't need a mixer. You just plug it right into the computer. The disadvantage of it is they're not pro. They tend not to be pro mics. And you can only use one of them. You can't have two USB mics plugged in. So as soon as you want to go to multiple mics, a mixer is going to be necessary anyway. I think Rode, R-O-D-E, makes a great mic called the Podcaster. That's under $200. It's a very good USB mic. A lot of people like the Blue Microphone Yeti, Y-E-T-I. Also around, I think it's around $200. I use an interesting combination of a Pro mic, the Shure SM58, but you could use any Pro mic, including, you mentioned, the Heils. In studios, I always use the Heils. We use nothing but Heils here in the Brick House studio. But for the road or banging things around, the SM58 is a great mic. It has good noise rejection. It's cheap. It's about $125. And Shure makes a bundle. You could buy it on Amazon or elsewhere. Of the SM58 mic plus its X2U converter that takes that traditional professional mic with the XLR connector and turns it into a USB mic. That bundle is around $200. If you shop around, you might even be able to buy it less. Amazon has it. So you want the SM, and I think this is a good, especially if you're ever going to go out in the field, because it's you don't have to soundproof anything. It just does a great job. And you can use this as a hammer. If you ever need a hammer, it's so tough. This is the mic they use in bars and clubs and everything. It's a Shure SM58 Plus X2U. A couple of recommendations here for you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I love this a cappella. It's a raw track, obviously, from Whitney Houston, one of her biggest hits, How Will I Know? And it's wonderful to hear her a cappella. And I have to think that though that particular track, which was distributed by a guy, he put it on the net, who was a former DJ, I'm told, at K-Rock. And because he's a DJ, he probably had, there's always been a bootleg kind of network for a lot of stuff. I'm not a big conspiracy guy, but I have to say, people share stuff. They share tapes. There's all sorts of stuff, wild tracks, outtakes, studio tracks from the Beatles and others. And in the past, it's really been limited to people who were, connected. And I have to say, I'm thrilled that this guy, I'm trying to find his name so I can send you to his site and break it, but thrilled that this guy who probably had this recording just because he was a DJ and it was passed around, put it up on the internet. Yeah, that's it. Jake Fogelnest. Thank you. And I just think it's this is one of the things that's so great about the internet. I have a friend. He's a talk show host up in Toronto, John Donaby, who over a period of 30 or 40 years interviewed everybody, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, everybody, and has those tapes in his garage on reel-to-reel. And I keep saying, John, I will come, I will fly to Toronto, I will come to your house, I will digitize those by hand, one by one, if you will let me put them on the internet. Because those are rare treasures. And this is, to me, this is the potential power of the internet. No-cost distribution of amazing stuff. Jake, I guess, was a VJ on VH1, and he hosted, as a teenager, a show on MTV. And I just, you know, normally it would just have been sitting in his closet, you know, lying around. He got it from somebody who got it from somebody who got it from somebody. And I just think it's a wonderful tribute to Whitney Houston. And now I'm going to say, inevitably, the record company who owns the rights to that song is going to go and is going to, I hope they don't do this, but is going to pull it down and maybe even sue him and say, with a complete misunderstanding of what the value of this is. Yeah, sure, they have the right to do that. They have a legal right, just as Apple has a legal right to pursue their patents. But I think that that kind of close-fisted attitude doesn't serve anyone, especially the people suing. You know, they're trying to extend copyright again. Copyright should go as it was originally intended, maybe 10, 20 years, to give the copyright holder the chance to reap the benefits of their creation. And then things should just go into public domain so that we can all build on it. You know who keeps extending copyright? It's the Walt Disney Corporation, because Mickey Mouse is copyright 1927. And they don't want anybody to have the rights to Mickey Mouse. So they keep going to the Congress and saying, hey, you mind extending that a little longer? And that's why copyright keeps getting longer and longer. But, you know, Walt Disney, need I point out, did quite well taking public domain works like Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, Snow White, and making them into movies. We all exist as artists, as creators, as humans, and create based on stuff we've seen before. We build upon the past, upon the public domain. My friend Larry Lessig calls it the creative commons that we all share. And when stuff is protected like that, it harms us. It harms society. Yeah, it's their right. It's, you know, and if they can get a law passed, it's legal and it's their right. But is it good for society? No. So I hope that Jake, you know, he took a little risk, didn't he, posting that track? And haven't we all gained such immense value from hearing Whitney's pure voice, her pure singing, and enjoying that? What a tribute to her. And, you know, I wouldn't even be surprised if Arista Records didn't sell a few extra copies of that song based on that. So I hope they have the good sense to say, hey, that's fine. That's great, Jake. Nice tribute. History tells us they probably won't. Jeff in Arkansas, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Love the show. I have a question about, I have four IP cameras. My wife owns a daycare, and we have a server running Windows Server 2008 on it. And I want to be able to stream those IP cameras to the internet so parents can watch their children during the day.
Yeah.
But I wanted to be able to do it securely I can issue them a username and password. Do you know of any way that I can do this?
You know, many of these, you call it an IP camera. That means a camera that that basically is a web server. It sits on the internet, has its own IP address, and you can surf over the net to that camera. I have to say, you want to be careful. TrendNet was recently exposed, this week in fact, as having a major security vulnerability. Now, TrendNet makes an IP-based camera with a secure, supposedly secure interface so that you can put it on the internet and you use the password and only you can see it. Well, a hacker discovered that, in fact, it isn't secure. There's a backdoor that lets you look at any TrendNet camera anywhere without a password. And there are search engines that let you search for these cameras So I'm going to take this as an opportunity, Jeff, to tell people if you're using a TrendNet camera, you might want to take it down. And don't buy a TrendNet, Jeff. Now, they'll fix this. But it is an important point that anytime you put something with a public face on the Internet, even if it's so-called password protected, there's always a risk. There's always a risk. However, if you're careful and you buy, and you keep an eye on, you know, nobody knew about this TrendNet thing until this week, so it probably was security through obscurity. It was secure because nobody knew how to break into it. So there are a number. You have the cameras, or you haven't purchased them yet?
I've already purchased them.
Okay, so you should check then with the vendor of that camera to see what they offer. I presume, since you say it's an IP camera, that it has an interface to the outside world.
Yes.
And it doesn't offer a password-protected interface?
Well, I'm trying to figure out how to get it to my existing website.
I see. So you want to put it... Yeah, because if you have it... By the way, if you put it on your website, then you can secure it yourself and then have a little bit more... Well, not really, because... that was the problem with the TrendNet. Let's say you had the TrendNet on the Internet and it was sending it to your website. People had to log into your website to see it. Turned out there was a backdoor. You could go directly to the TrendNet and get into it. So even then, it would be vulnerable. What you need is software that, instead of acting as a... Let me think. So it has an IP address. People can surf to that IP address, but what you want them to do is go to your site. I guess you could write software that would grab the video from that camera IP address and rebroadcast it on your system. You want it live video? You want it live video?
Yes.
So you're going to have to look at the camera you're using and see what they offer. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. See, that's exactly my point. Extending copyright breaks the circle of life. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know, we can play these songs because we pay them. They get a license fee from us. So we're licensed to do that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So our last caller posed a really interesting conundrum, a thought problem. And this is why security is so hard. Because you really have to think about all the possible ways something could be used. He has IP cameras. He wants to point them at kids and then make a web page, you know, in a daycare situation, wants to make a web page. Obviously, password protected. You don't want strangers looking at people's kids, but have a password protected portal to those cameras. When I take Ozzy, my dog, to our local, dog play center, it's called Fit and Furry. They have a webcam there, and you can go online and look at the webcam. But there's not a privacy concern with people looking at my dog. There would be with your kids, right? And this is where the devil's in the details. So the easy, obvious way to do this, if you've got a camera with a internet address that's visible, you know, you could send people to that camera. But you don't want to do that. You want to protect it. So what you could do is you could create a web page that had embedded within that web page what's called an iframe. Iframes are very, very commonly used on the Internet. It's essentially a web page within a web page. So you could, on your mydaycare.com, have an iframe, and inside that iframe could be the IP camera's web page itself. So people go there, you can make it, you got to log in to go to that camera, that web page. And now they're seeing on that web page, they're seeing the camera. There are some security issues with that. First of all, anybody who can get to that page now knows the address of the camera. Because you just look at the source code of the web page and you can easily see in the iframe where the camera is coming from. But wait a minute, it's okay because we did make people get in via password, so presumably only parents are seeing that iframe. But there may also be issues during the transmission of that information, because that camera is still going out of the public web. So anybody who can intercept that transmission can see, oh, yeah, there's a camera there. So ultimately, in order for you to safely use a camera that has a public face on it of any kind, that camera has to be secure, has to offer built-in within itself security, and security that works. And that's the problem. And as we've seen with this TrendNet camera, we don't know how long that those cameras were visible, and we don't know how long hackers knew about it. Could be every single person who set up a TrendNet internet camera in their home was being spied upon. We just don't know. Now, TrendNet's offered a fix, but that's great, but it doesn't necessarily make me feel completely secure. And if you have a fiduciary responsibility, as you do as the owner of a daycare center, to keep those kids protected and private, I think the risk is high, probably higher than the reward of putting anything on the public internet with the pictures of those kids, even if you think you've locked it down. There's all sorts of, you know, potential problems. And that's, security is very, very difficult. And the trouble begins as soon as you have a public face. And I've said this many times, and really this is the bottom line. Unless you really know what you're doing, and even if you really know what you're doing, you should assume that anything that's placed on the internet is public, period. The internet is a public place. If you put something on the internet, I know, oh, no, it's on Facebook. It's private. No, I've got a password on that. If you put something on the internet, just presume that it's public, and then you'll never get into trouble. Yeah, maybe it's possible. Maybe you could do it. Presume it's public. My advice to anybody who wants to put a IP camera, a camera with its own web interface out on the net, is you should only do that if the images that are coming from that camera are public. Period. Stephen 3X says it right. He says the internet is the equivalent of sending a postcard through the mail. You know, it's probably the case the mail carrier is not reading the postcard, but he could. We're going to take a break, come back. We have another caller on the line in just a second. Actually, Scott in Homeland, California wants to get a Roku. Well, let's talk. Scott, Homeland, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Leo. I listen to you fairly regularly, and I really find it interesting. I'm sort of an illiterate internet individual. Anyway, and I have always, I know people who have the Roku, and so I bought one of the little boxes the other day, and it just came, and I think I may be jumping the gun by calling you, I don't know, but do I have to program something into it or whatever, or do I just plug it in and it goes, or do I have to have a hard line?
Yeah, let's talk about it, because I'm a Roku fan. I love Roku. I have a Roku on every TV in my house. So what Roku, that is the idea behind Roku, is it basically is an internet connection for your television. And since so much stuff is now on the internet, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, music services like Pandora, it's really great when you've connected your home theater system to the internet, you can get all that stuff. Modern TVs, by the way, many of them now have this built in. But if you don't, Roku is a very inexpensive, efficient way of adding that. And I hope you have this. You also have to have an internet connection. Do you have that, Scott?
Yes.
Oh, good.
it's wireless, and that's what I was hoping.
It doesn't have to be wireless, because Roku does have an Ethernet jack on the back. So if your TV is near your Ethernet, your wireless router, you could just make a wired connection. And that's actually the best kind of connection, because then you don't have to worry about, you know, wireless speeds can vary and so forth. But if you have Wi-Fi and you don't have a connection nearby, I use Wi-Fi, I don't have a direct connection. So the first thing you'll do when you turn on the Roku is you will connect it to Wi-Fi.
Okay.
And if you have a password, you'll have to enter that in. Roku will walk you through that. Now the Roku's online. And immediately, you have a little remote control. If you press the home button, there's a house button on it. If you press the home button, it'll take you to the main Roku menu. That menu contains all the things you can do with Roku, including a Roku channel store that lets you add more channels. For instance, they have HBO Go on there. So if you have a cable company with an HBO subscription, you can watch HBO on your Roku, even if that TV's not hooked up to the cable. If you like hockey, they have NHL. If you like football, they've got the NFL. If you like baseball, they've got the Major League Baseball. But in each case, you have to have a subscription with those services. So, for instance, if you go to the Netflix, and it'll walk you through this. It'll say, okay, good. Now you've got to connect your Netflix account to this Roku. And that's pretty straightforward.
Okay.
So I think, Scott, right. I don't mind. In fact, I'm glad you called because it gave me a chance to talk about the product. But I think when you plug it into your TV, you'll best to plug it in with an HDMI cable if your TV supports that.
I bought a cable with it.
You're so set, yeah. So really, it's going to be straightforward. You plug the Roku into the power, into the wall. You plug the HDMI cable from the Roku into your TV set. And then you go to that HDMI input, and you'll see the Roku menu, and it'll walk you through the rest. Really, one of my favorite products. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. And it's time, to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater at 12:33, 33 after the hour. Actually, all right, to be exact, 33 minutes and 30 seconds after the hour. Chris Marquardt joins us to talk digital photography. I love my chat room. Without the chat room, and by the way, you can join that chat room by going to our website, techguylabs.com. I would not know so many things. Just in the break, they told me so many things. For instance, we were talking about Roku and the variety of channels on Roku. There is a database of channels, some private, some you have to have access, be given access to. But it's roku-channels.com, and there are 603 channels on the Roku. These are all through the internet. All kinds of stuff. Amazing variety of internet video via the Roku, including Australian rules football, which I love, and Amazon and Hulu, and I mean, it goes on. Bravo, and just goes on and on. You can watch. I didn't mention, but you can watch my programming on. There's a Twit app in the channel store. Search for Twit. Thanks to Craig Mullaney, Shift Key Software. He's Houdini7 in the chat room. He wrote that program, and that makes all of the shows that I do, 30 plus a week, all about technology, available on the Roku. And you can watch us stream, where you can watch this show live and all the live shows we do live on the Roku on your big screen TV, either on the Twit Network app or on Justin.tv or Ustream.tv. So there. I forgot to mention that. So I just love Roku. They start at $50. It's a great way to add the internet to your television. Also being told right now from the chat room, and I confirmed it, that Steam is down. That's kind of scary. Steam is a great way to play games on your PC or Mac. Lots of games on there. You download them online and play them. And some of the best games are out there are Steam games like Skyrim, Elder Scrolls V, and so forth. Or is it 4? But it's down right now. So that's a big deal. I'm not sure why. Many of these networks have been under attack lately by Anonymous and others. It's Elder Scrolls V. Thank you. What else did the chat room tell me in the break? There was one more thing that we were talking about. We're talking about a very funny page. Atort, who's a photographer in the chat room, has a friend who has gone viral with his dog's underwater pictures. In fact, at this point, you can't get to his site. It's so popular. Maybe you've seen them on Facebook. Amazing pictures. I guess he has an underwater camera, and then he plays catch with his dogs or throws balls into the pool and takes pictures of these dogs as they dive, and they're hysterical. They're hysterical. It's amazing. Finally, they told me about this Kickstarter. Project. Do you know what Kickstarter? Kickstarter is such a great idea. There are a number of sites like this. Kickstarter is the best known. It is a site where if you have a project and you need funding, you can go there. Maybe it's a TV show, or maybe you've got a great product you'd like to make. One of the best known Kickstarter projects was that the wristwatch band for iPod Nano. Somebody observed that a Nano would make a great wristwatch because it's got a clock on it and everything and all your music. If you could only have a band for it, so they created a prototype, made a video, went on Kickstarter and said, hey, if we can raise enough money, we can manufacture these. They raised enough money. and the bands became reality. So it's really kind of a cool way to crowdsource funding for your idea. So there's a group of people who want to make a game. They call it Double Fine Adventure. You know, it's expensive to do a video game. Costs a lot of money. Double Fine Productions is led by a guy who's done quite a few games, including Grim Fandango and Day of the Tentacle. And he's got a group of people together. He's talked a little bit about what the game would be like, but he said, I need money to do it. And so he asked for $400,000 seed capital. So people went to the website, Kickstarter website, and pledged, yeah, if you get enough pledges, you get $400,000 in pledges, we'll give you $5, $10, whatever. I think for $15, he gives you the game on Steam. For $30, you get an HD download of a documentary about the making of the game and the game. For $100, you get a poster. You know, so the more you give, the more you get. 8 hours after posting this, not only did they raise $400,000, they are now at $1.6 million with 46,000 donors. It went viral, didn't it? So many people liked this on Facebook or tweeted about it or told their friends. They've got 46,000 backers and a total of $1.6 million in 8 hours. That just shows you the success of this Kickstarter and this model, this idea of instead of, as you know, you would traditionally do, go to a bank and get a loan or go to venture capitalists and raise money, they go to the public. And they don't have to give away bits of their company. They don't have to pay back the money. They just give, you know, so 25,000 of these pledges were just for $15, so they get the game. Essentially, all you're saying is, I'll buy the game ahead of time. So if you develop it. Now, I have to admit, this has some potential problems. If the game doesn't, you know, for one reason or another, get finished, you're still out the money. So you're kind of taking a flyer on this. I have purchased things on Kickstarter. I purchased some gaming dice, which I've never seen. I can't remember how much I gave them. I don't even know. And I keep getting emails from these guys as if this is going to happen. They sucked me in with this great description, this great game. And I said, what the heck, $15 or whatever. But I'll probably never see that money again, and I don't think I'll ever see the dice. So there is a risk involved, kind of inherent. But what a good idea. And it just gives me hope because it means that if you're a filmmaker, for instance, and you remember... was it Robert Rodriguez, who maxed out his credit cards to make some films. He's a very well-known filmmaker now to make his first films. He now probably in this era, if he were of this generation, he'd just go to Kickstarter. Just a great idea. You're right. It's great, as somebody in the chat room, Web1653, says in the chat room, it's great if people know you or you have a way of publicizing it. Or if you do something that's so cool that people just go, yeah, And tell their friends. It is not like buying stock. You do not get a share of the profits. They tell you very clearly on the Kickstarter page what you get. I guess they could offer you a share of profits. Usually not. In the case of this game, you say, I'll pay $15 in advance to give you money to develop the game, and then I get a copy of the game when it comes out. If it comes out. I'm sure it will. 8888 Ask Leo. Anyway, thank you, chat room. Boy, they gave me a lot of tidbits for the show. You can visit our chat room. Join the 1,000-plus people, the kids in the back of the class, by going to the website, techguylabs.com. Techguylabs.com. And click the chat link there. There's also show notes. Thanks to James DeRuvo. Every time I mention something like this Kickstarter project, James will put a link to it in the show notes so you don't have to remember the name or anything. Just go to the show notes, and we keep those show notes up to date. All 848 shows that we've ever done are there at techguylabs.com, including the links to the audio and the video of each and every show. Susan, Laguna Woods, California, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Leo. Love your show,
Thank you.
I don't understand most of it.
It is foreign language programming for many, but that's okay. You know, you'll learn via osmosis.
I've gotten a lot of tips. I have a very simple question.
Actually, Susan, I'm glad it's simple, but we do have to take a break. Hang on. You're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
The human world, it's a mess. Life under the sea is better than anything they got out there. The seaweed is always greener in somebody else's lake. You dream about...
Who let the dogs in? Leo Laporte. There are no dogs under the sea.
Right here on the ocean floor. Such wonderful things around you. What more is...
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK. Leo, we were talking to Susan. I'm so sorry, Susan. I had to put you off there for a minute. But nothing can get in the way of the commercials.
Problem.
You understand that?
I do, and I'm glad my dogs aren't barking.
I know. My dog, Ozzy, who is a Papillon, and normally is very sensitive to that. He's quietly watching me, as if I reproachfully. But
It would be like them just to bark when I've got you on the phone.
Of course it would.
Anyway, they're being good doggies.
Good.
My question for all senior citizens is, I'm embarking on my first smartphone. I'm with Verizon, and I would like you to recommend a phone for me.
Now, a lot of times I do recommend the Windows phones for first time. The new Windows phones are very easy to use for first time buyers. Unfortunately, I don't believe Verizon actually. Let me see if they have one. I have to log into my... Every time I go to shop at Verizon, they say, well, where do you live? So I have to put in my zip code and all of that, and I'll tell you. You know, I think for most people, I hear you doggies, for most people, the iPhone is probably the right way to go. Android phones, which Verizon has aplenty as well, they're the ones who do droids, are, I think, a little bit more for the geek, a little more for tweaking.
Okay.
Let me just see what else
Verizon
they have.
Has the iPhone?
They do, and that was a big change made last year that both Verizon and Sprint started to sell the iPhone. I think for a first-time buyer, first-time smartphone, yeah, you could make a case. They do have the HTC Trophy, which is a Windows 7.5 phone. But I got to think the iPhone be the right choice for you. Susan, do you have a computer?
Good enough. And thanks to you, I graduated to Mac. I have a MacBook Pro, and I recently got an iPad 2, and I'm cooking along.
So in that case, I think the iPhone is a very good choice for you.
Okay.
Yeah. Once you're in the Apple universe, it just all kind of chunk clicks together.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Susan.
I really appreciate your taking my stupid call.
That's not
Thank
stupid.
Thank you. I love you.
All right, I love you too. It's a great call. Are you kidding? That's the right, that's the kind of call I love to take, cuz I think, did you see Saturday Night Live? Let me see if I can play this. Saturday Night Live last night, and the fun they made of Verizon. Actually, it's very apropos. Coming up in just a bit, I'm going to look this up here, and I will play it for you in a second, breaking all copyright laws. Coming up in just a bit at 33 after the hour, Chris Marquardt, he's going to talk about a project that we got involved in that I think is really cool, sending a camera all over the world, a disposable camera. The camera started here. We sent it to Ohio. It is in Antarctica now. And I'm trying to load the smartphone skit right now from Saturday Night Live. It's perfect, really, for Susan and everybody who is confused by smartphone marketing these days. Why is it taking so long? I hate the internet. Do you ever hate the internet? I hate the internet every once in a while. It just kills you. Here we go. This is from NBC. I hope there's not an ad at the beginning of it. Maybe there is. Yeah, advertisement starting. Thank you, NBC. We'll just wait through the ad for a moment. You know, this at least they learned their lesson. For a long time, they blocked clips from YouTube and other places from Saturday Night Live. In fact, when YouTube first started, it almost got, stillborn because NBC was so mad about Saturday Night Live and Lazy Sunday. That's what kicked YouTube off. Finally, NBC realized, oh... This promotes it. Here you go. This is from last night's Saturday Night Live.
A lot about Verizon's new 4G LTE.
Ah, you should be. It's Verizon's fastest, most reliable 4G network. With 4G LTE, you'll get speeds up to 10 times faster than 3G.
So what does that mean?
Well, let's say you've got the new HTC Thunderbolt or even the LG Vortex. You can hook up your HTC or your LG to your 4G LTE, and you'll have Verizon's 4G LTE in over 190 cities and 118 airports.
So it's faster?
Well, let's say you've got the new Droid Razr by Motorola, or the HTC Resound, or even the Samsung Galaxy Nexus. You're talking 4G LTE on almost our entire 3G footprint. One song, 4 seconds.
The song is 4 seconds?
One movie, 1 hour.
Download?
A 10 megabyte PowerPoint presentation in 15 seconds.
I really don't know what that means.
Are you a small business owner?
No, I live off a settlement.
You're a Native American.
Not on a settlement, off a settlement. I got clipped by a city bus.
Got it. Well, let's say you were starting a small business and you want to run the entire business from your smartphone.
Oh, I wouldn't want to do that.
Like your Droid Razr, your HTC Resound, or even your Samsung Galaxy Nexus.
That sounds terrible.
Here's your 3G network.
What?
Put it this way. If you want 4G LTE, then you have to buy a Droid Bionic,
or a Samsung Stratus,
or a Pantech Breakout,
or a Compact Mini Netbook,
or the Droid Zyboard Tablet.
And what if I drop it in the toilet?
It breaks immediately.
Thanks.
And the tagline?
Verizon. It's an old person's nightmare.
Verizon, it's an old person's nightmare. You know what? Young people, too, it's very, very confusing. And there's so many products out there. And I think in some ways, that's probably the best solution. Just go buy an iPhone. You don't worry about it. that was, and I'll give them credit, NBC, Saturday Night Live, 11:30. Watch it. There you go. And you know, I have to say that they hit the nail on the head. And the fact that they ran it and people were laughing shows that everybody agrees it's just way confusing. Way confusing. Now, I'm going to confuse it more, Susan. They don't have 4G LTE on the iPhone yet. They will probably when the next iPhone comes out, I would guess. But you know what? You don't. That's fine. That's fine. Don't worry about it. It's okay. Ray in Los Angeles, Leo LaPorte, the tech guy. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Leo. Love your show. I listen to you every Saturday and Sunday while I'm working out.
Yes, and good.
I get body and mind improvement.
Wonderful.
Outlook 2010 mail. How come you can't, when somebody sends you like 10 pictures, they don't show up on your preview pane? You've got to click on every one to show it or download them all.
I think that's an option in your Outlook mail. Chatroom might have to help me out on this one. It used to be, you're right, you would see what's called inline images. And I think that's a setting. So what I would suggest is look in your Outlook settings and see if you can enable inline image display. It's probably a security issue. In fact, I'm sure it's a security issue because there is potential risk in rendering images, rendering HTML in an email. But I wouldn't worry about it. So go to options. Jeff N. says it's in security advanced. Of course, that's the first place you'd look, right? Security and advanced, and re-enable inline images. Look, I don't like email attachments for a number of reasons, and I've said for years, don't open attachments because it's potentially risky. Viewing the image is the same as opening the image, by the way. The other reason I don't like inline attachments is because it uses up a lot of bandwidth. Some of those images can be quite big. You add 20 images to an email, it could be a 10 megabyte email. And some people, that's bigger than their inbox. So it's almost always better to put those images on a website, Flickr or Picasa, and then send a link. However, images are pretty safe. I wouldn't worry about it. Go ahead and re-enable inline images, Ray. Leo LaPorte, the tech guy. Chris Marquardt is here. He's our photo guy, the host of the Tips from the Top Floor podcast. He does workshops, does great photography, and joins us every week to talk about digital photography. He's at chrismarquardt.com. He's joining us now from Germany. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Leo. Hi.
I am well. So thank you for getting me involved in this camera project.
Is it fun?
I love the idea. Tell people about this.
Okay, so it's called the Disposable Memory Project. It's at disposablememoryproject.org. What they do is they send out disposable cameras, and they hand them off to people, or you can actually get one there, I think, or use your own and get some instructions there. And then those cameras travel. People take pictures, and the camera gets handed off to someone else, or maybe sent to someone else. And I talked to them, and they sent a camera to the Twit Brickhouse, right?
Yes. And I took a couple of pictures. And then the question was, well, where do we send the camera? Or, you know, we get people from all, the truth is, we get people from all over the world visiting. So I figured, well, it's not going to be a big deal. I can just give it to somebody. But then one of our regular listeners, who is a professor at Ohio State, Terry Mensing, said, hey, I have some colleagues who are about to leave for Antarctica.
Yeah, Darth Emma actually.
Darth Emma in our chat room. Yep. That's right.
Right.
So, wow, that's pretty awesome.
It's in Antarctica right now.
What
people do when they find the camera is they go on a website and they basically fill out a little form that says where the camera is right now and how it got there and where it's going to go next. So that's what's happening right now. It is at Antarctica at the McMurdo Research Base, Ross Island, Antarctica. And once the camera is done, the last station for the camera will be the Disposable Memory Project.
It gets mailed back to them. Alice P., who has it, she's a technician at McMurdo. She's leaving in 12 days for New Zealand. So it's gone from Petaluma, California, where it started with me. I took two images here. Went then to Marysville, Ohio, where Terry, I think, took a few pictures. Alice has taken a few. Now, we're up to 32 photos on the camera, so I don't know how many total, but I think we're going to fill this thing up. It's already traveled 7,422 miles, and it's got a few more miles left in it. Then what? Did they develop the pictures? What happens then?
Well, it goes back to the Disposable Memory Project. They develop it, and then they put it online, and then you'll be able to see it. It's camera 394, so that's the number it's referenced by, and then you will be able to see the pictures and the trip the camera made on their website.
It's kind of a fun idea.
It's an awesome idea. Yeah. And it's an idea that you wouldn't do with a digital camera, but that's what disposable cameras are pretty much made for. I really like that.
Yeah, I only think we have a few images left, so I have a feeling that most of the pictures are going to be Antarctica, but that's fine. That's okay. If you find a camera, lying around or somebody gives it to you, you could get all the instructions camera, it says go to this website and here, and we'll tell you what to do. Do most of them make it back? Do you know?
I don't think more than half of them actually make it back. Yeah. We had one up at Everest Base Camp, and that never made it back for 3 years now. So
it's still it's not over.
It might be somewhere. Yeah, film doesn't age that fast.
Could happen. It could happen. Their next project, by the way, if you go to disposablememoryproject.org. They have a new project for this year. They call it the 100, and they're looking for people from ages 1 to 100, and they still have some spaces left. In fact, I noticed they don't have any 55-year-olds. I might apply. Each of them will get a disposable camera. See, it's another disposable camera project, and then take pictures of what it's like to be that age. I don't know what the one-year-old pictures are going to look like,
but it's funny, probably.
these guys are very creative. Are they in Germany? Where are they located?
They are in the UK, I think.
UK, okay. Very interesting. Very interesting. You don't still use film of any kind, do you?
I do, absolutely. Whenever I need limitation. I need, in order to get creative, I need some constraint.
Now, that's interesting, because I think a lot of people would say, well, no, to be creative, I need no constraints. All these constraints are keeping me from being creative. You say the opposite.
Absolutely. Constraints make you more creative. You remember like bands in the old days when they had almost nothing, just a reel-to-reel tape to record an entire album. And that was great, great music. And then when they got a big contract and all of a sudden they got lots of money to produce and all of a sudden quality went downhill. That is what happens when you don't have constraints.
That's so you'll use a film camera as a constraint.
I shoot film whenever I shoot for just leisure on the weekends, when I don't do a photo job. When I work for clients, I usually shoot digital. But I will even go out with a large format camera and shoot five pictures in a day.
Wow. So that's a constraint. You saw then probably the very sad news that Kodak has decided to get out of the – of course, they got out of the film business some time ago.
No. Kodak still makes film. They got out of the camera business.
They have one plant that still makes ektachrome. One.
They have. They still do a lot of black and well, a few black and white films, I'm hoping that they won't give up.
Maybe because they are getting they. It's so weird because they announced, I think, 6 new digital cameras at CES last month, and then this week they said, as part of their Chapter 11 reorganization, we're going to discontinue all digital cameras.
Actually, the film business is apparently still the one profitable business they have. So. I would be surprised if that dies.
So I guess you can. I'm looking, and you can buy ektachrome, which is their kind of classic slide film, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you shoot film, do you use Kodak film?
I use Kodak film, black and white, T-Max, Tri-X. I also shoot Fuji slide film. So I have at least 5 different.
I used to shoot Panax and Tri-X. I miss those days, actually.
Tri-X, they still make Tri-X.
Yeah, all right. So maybe Kodak will survive as a film company, kind of one of those retro things. You know, there's people who use vinyl records still, and people still who shoot film, and I guess somebody's got to serve them. It's not going to be the big multi-billion-dollar business that it used to be. One more question I want to ask you. This is another development that happened this week. Nikon announced a new camera, the D800. Yep. It's a $3,000. Now, you may choke at that. That's just for the body. You don't even get a lens for that. That's the list price. But actually, that's an amazing price for this camera because it's 36.3 megapixels.
Yeah, it's an amazing camera. When I saw the news, you know what? The really amazing point about this camera is that it has a full quality HDMI output, which lots of people won't ever need. But if you shoot in a studio, if you shoot video, that's what you want. And Canon can't do that because they have a camera business that they don't want to cannibalize. So
you're saying that I could hook up an HDMI cable to this camera and use it as a video camera?
Uncompressed full quality.
Wow. And at $3,000, that now doesn't sound so bad. One of the nice things about doing video on a SLR like this is you have a broad range of lenses that you could use, from wide angles to telephotos to very fast lenses. And I imagine this supports all the Canon lenses. I'm sorry, Nikon, not Canon Nikon lenses.
Yeah, it does. It does. You have an excellent selection of really good lenses. And you have the big sensor, which makes the video that comes out look very cinematic, very much like film used to look in the cinema still does.
Wow. Maybe I should buy one of these. You've given me an excuse. Thank you. That's all I really needed. They do have some video on. I don't know how compressed internet video is going to help you understand how good this camera is, but they do on the Nikon USA site have a video shot with this camera. Supposedly, I've been told by those who pre-ordered, they expected it in March. Chris Marquardt, chrismarquardt.com. You'll find a link on our show notes too at techguylabs.com. Thanks for joining us. I'll tell you about our assignment when we come back. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Once again, Kyle Benham, our musical director, has hit the nail on the head with that song. He makes his playlist available, by the way, after the show on his Google Plus account, KYLE/BENHAM. We'll also link to it on our website, techguylabs.com. Music is apropos because that's our assignment this month. Every month, Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, gives us an assignment, not a contest, not a competition, no prizes. It's just frankly, an excuse to go out there and take some pictures with whatever camera you've got, even your smartphone. And what we do is we give you a topic. So this month, it's music. Music. So whatever that means to you, take a picture, tag it with the word music, upload it to Flickr. You need a Flickr account, but they're free. Or if you're already on Yahoo, you already have one. And then join the Tech Guy group, TECH/GUI. On Flickr and upload it. You get to upload a picture every week, so you can have as many as 4 pictures up there. Chris will pick 3 of them for his review in a couple of weeks right here on the show. Music is our topic of the month. John in Visalia, California is our caller of the hour. Hi, John. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
Wonderful. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Hey, I remember last week you were talking about that you didn't know anybody that didn't have a flat screen yet. Well, I'm one of them.
You're the guy, huh?
Yeah, I'm one of them. So I'm kind of looking for one, But then I hear you and Scott Wilkinson there, you know, you guys talking about the plasma TVs and the LEDs, how the plasmas last a little longer, the LEDs with the little, you know, LCD with the LED backlit. But then you guys talking about the little blue lights going out on them.
Yeah, those are the OLEDs. That's a little. That's another kind of TV that isn't out yet. The OLEDs. Really, your choice today is LCD with an LED backlight or plasma. Those are the two choices. And frankly, either one would be fine.
Either one?
Yeah. My suggestion: if you watch and you can't darken the room, then LCD is probably the best. They call them LEDs, but it's the same thing. They're probably the best because they're brightest. If you can darken the room, you'll get the more accurate home theater experience with blacker blacks and better high-speed action and motion on a plasma screen. Plasmas tend to be bigger and heavier and hotter. They use more power. I actually have two plasmas in my house. I like plasma. But everywhere in the studio, we have about 30 screens. They're all LCDs here in the studio. So I think there's nothing wrong with either. They're great choices, and they're great manufacturers out there. Samsung, Sony is still still makes a great TV. LG is excellent. Panasonic, of course, for plasma. Panasonic right now is, I think, one of the best. So you have a lot of choices. And, in fact, if you want to save money, Vizio is a good choice in kind of the second tier. If you go to a big box store, you'll see a lot of Vizios. But truth is, you got a lot of choices out there. I think you'd be pretty hard to go wrong. You waited just the right amount of time, John. The prices are remarkably low.
Yeah, I checked the advertisements to come out in the little weekend paper, you know. So, yeah, they're coming down pretty much.
They really are, yeah. My suggestion is just get as big as you can.
Okay.
Bigger is almost always better. People underestimate because, you know, that old TV in your house, what is it, 32 inches at best?
I got one. It's a CRT. That's a 35. And then I got a projection. That's a 57.
Ah, well, you already have projection, so I guess that's the flattest of flat screens. But CRTs, a 35-inch CRT is deep, is long, because those tubes have to be very big. And
right.
So that really is kind of the limit on CRTs. They can't make them too big. But on HD, you 35 is too small. So right. I would suggest if you've got the room for it to start at 50 inches and go 60 if you've got the room and can afford it.
Right. I've measured the space and all that. Yeah, I have a room for 60.
Go for it,
where
then.
The 35 is.
Bigger is better. And of course, the farther away you sit, the even bigger you want.
Right.
I think you're going to get a. I think you're going to get a great deal. You don't have to worry about the lifespan of either plasma or LCD LED backlit. All of them will go at least 10 years of 8 hours nonstop viewing each and every day. You're not going to wear the thing out.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Then one more little question. Quick
sure.
Question. Your opinion on that? The Denon, the AVR, the 1912 receiver.
Love them.
Pretty good.
Yep.
Okay, my wife was wanting to buy one of them for me, but I wanted to check it out first.
No, I think Denon's a very, very good brand.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call.
Okay,
I appreciate
you.
It. Bye. Denon and Onkyo are in the kind of, you know, don't bet the farm price range. Very good. Very good. And somebody in the chat room, David Bix in the chat room, is suggesting ScreenMath.com. As a place where you can do an online calculation for how big your screen should be, depending on how far away from it you're seated. And I think if you go there, you will be amazed at how big that TV should be. Much bigger than you think, depending on your distance and who you listen to. If you ScreenMath.com has been around for some years, in fact, is a little conservative in the screen size. If you go to, say, THX or Dolby and look at their calculators, they're trying to give you a home theater experience bigger than you think. Steve is on the line from Idaho. Hi, Steve. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. A huge fan. I've been listening to you since CDTV, and I call you today as the reluctant webmaster, I guess. This does certainly tie into to the Google changes, but basically I had a friend of mine who makes engraved rocks over at rocketcreations.com, and he had an ancient website, probably about 12 years old, HTML-based. It was terrible, and he had great traffic, but his conversion rate was exceptionally low, so we went ahead and put up a new dynamic site. And the problem we have is he has another site that's not a subdomain. It is an actual domain, but we couldn't 301 redirect without breaking the other site because the gal who had built both these sites before basically made them almost virtually identical. So our traffic is through the floor. And
basically, you split the traffic in two.
Not quite, but the thing is with all the new URLs and everything else, not being able to do those 301 redirects, we basically lost the ranking that we'd had for years. And basically, we're in deep crud. He's about ready to go bankrupt here within the next month if we can't turn this around. And I'm,
So people understand what you're talking about, 301 redirect. It's when you go to a web page that's not there, the web server can send an error code back to your browser. 404, you've all seen, page not found. But there are other ones that are less commonly used but are perhaps more appropriate. The one you're talking about is moved permanently. It's just like telling the post office, please, this don't use this address anymore. All the mail should be going to the other address. And the reason this is important is you want to tell Google, hey, we've moved to this other address. Please accrue all of the traffic to the new address. And that's your issue. Now, that's an analytics issue, though. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're losing the traffic. I guess Google's giving the wrong results.
Google just basically got a bunch of 404s. So
they got 404s. Yeah. So Google assumed the site was gone.
Correct. And I went through, changed all the site links, all that kind of stuff. But I think it might actually also tie into this, the new personalized search results, because although we have a Google Plus account, we don't have anybody on it currently, as that's brand new to try to do the social media thing.
We got to take a break for the top of the hour. Let me think a little bit on this and talk in general about what to do to raise your Google ranking. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, and it's time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo is the number if you want to join me and talk about tech. Ask a question, make a suggestion, make a comment. Had a guy in a lot of pain at the end of the last hour. He has a friend who has a website that's going down fast. They moved it around. Google got confused. Google got the wrong message from the web server. He thinks they're not showing up in search results as a result. There's not a lot you can do except to go to Google and Webmaster Central, google.com/webmasters. And there are tools there. First of all, a great place to go to learn about how Google sees your site, how they link it, how they list it. Find out who links to you, and to submit to Google information about your site. And you might be able to go there and let Google know the site's moved. Take all that incoming Google traffic or incoming link traffic and assign it to the new site. You might. You might not. So many people, unfortunately, so many people try to game Google these days to artificially enhance their ranking on Google search results. Or to let Google use a link farm and things like that to trick Google, that it makes it makes Google very frankly suspicious. A guy named Matt Cutts is in charge of their spam fighting team. He's the guy who tries to keep phony results, spammy results out of the Google search results, and it's a nonstop battle. He's a great guy, very friendly, very nice, but I have to say, I don't envy him his job, because there's so much value to being ranked highly on Google that, of course, when something is of value, you get a lot of people trying to game it. And one of the side effects is Google is a little more suspicious and a little less likely to adjust results just because you say so. If you're going to have any success, you're going to have to go through Google's front door, google.com/webmasters, and I wish you luck. I hope that they will listen and will adjust the results for you. Don in Santa Rosa, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Don.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. You know, I love your show, and it's great to have a resource like yourself for an old, technically challenged old guy like myself.
Awesome.
My question is, we have an old phone, and we need a new one, but the only reason we don't get that new one is that we have messages on there from our grandkids that go years back.
Oh, you don't want to lose those. I know what you mean.
I don't want to lose them. So we hang on with this phone that you can barely hear. It's lousy, and yet we don't want to get rid of it because of that. Is there some way that I could get those messages and save them?
So it's an answering machine attached to the phone, I guess. Is it cassette-based or is it digital?
It's digital.
It's digital.
It's an old Uniden wall phone.
Got it. So it's saved on the digital chip inside that Uniden.
Yes.
Yeah. Does the Uniden, here's a couple of choices. Does the Uniden have an ability to call into it remotely to pick up messages?
Yes.
Ah,
it does.
You are in luck then. So what you need to do is make a phone call to the Uniden that is recorded. And there are several ways to do that. The easiest free way to do that is to create a Google Voice account.
Okay.
Which is voice.google.com. If you already have a Google account, a Gmail account or a Google account of any kind, you just log into that.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah. And what Google Voice will do, it's actually very handy to have, is it will let you create a Google Voice phone number that you can give to people. And that phone number can do a lot of things. You can have voicemails saved there or forwarded to people. And you can have calls to your home line be forwarded to the Google Voice. None of that you care about. But it's good to kind of check out what it's capable of because it's a free service that has a lot of value, including, by the way, free long-distance calls anywhere in the U.S., at least for the rest of the year. So, let's see. Oh, now somebody's telling me you can't record outbound calls, only incoming calls. Is that the case? Yeah. Oh, so this isn't a good solution.
I just want to be able to, like,
I understand. You want to save this. Now, I thought, they're telling me in the chat room I'm wrong, so I have to take it back. But I thought you could use your Google Voice number. So you make a call from Google Voice to the answering machine, enter in the codes you want to play back the recordings, and Google Voice has a button that you press. I think it's 5 that will, 5-star, something like that, that will record the phone call. And then on Google Voice, on the web, and now you can download that file to your computer. You can edit it up. You can save it forever.
So that's
one solution. You could conference it, I guess. It's getting a little more complicated, isn't it? Well, obviously the other way is to hold up a recorder to the playback, and that would be easy. And it wouldn't be necessarily bad. Do you have a recorder of any kind? Even a cell phone, most of them nowadays have audio recording.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. And of course, Radio Shack sells phone taps that let you record phone calls, which is another way you can do it. I just would love to do it digitally, somehow because since you can call into that Uniden and dial, the code 0000, whatever it is, and have it play back messages.
Right.
Skype will let you do that, I guess. I'm just looking at the chat room because Twilio, is that another way to do it? All right. I'll tell you what, we're going to have to... The chat room has some interesting solutions, all of which are incredibly complicated.
Yeah, and I'm not that, swift on this, but, I do understand some of it. It needs to be simple, though. And it would be nice to be able to just bring it up on the computer and listen to
them. That's why I thought this Google Voice would be so great, because then it's on the computer and you can listen to it anytime, and you can email it. You could share it. You could still do this with a conference call, I guess, if you had, because Google Voice lets you make 3-way calls.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at all of the different. The chat room's going crazy, having fun for this, having fun with this.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. So, I would have to try this. I'm trying to imagine how it would work. I think probably the easiest thing certainly would be to all right, there you go. This is a good way to do it. Of course, I don't know why I didn't think about this before. Most voice conference call systems allow you to record as well. So you could. How do you get the answering machine in the conference call chat room? Well, I'll tell you what. I don't want to waste a lot of time thinking about it. I'm gonna consult with the chat room during the break. We'll put an answer in our show notes, techguylabs.com, or at least a few answers. But probably the simplest way to do this, if you've got anything that can make an audio recording, your smartphone would be a good choice if you've got one, is hold it up and play back the answering machine messages. You know what? That's what I do. And then you've got a recording. If there is a mic jack on the Uniden, that would make it easier. Here's one from Steven3x called Skylook, skylook.biz. Let me look this up. I love this. This is a great challenge, and a lot of people want to do this. It's not unusual for people want to do this. Your inbox Skypeified brings your Skype. Yeah, I don't think that's it either. Lots of good ideas. I think the simplest is probably the best. Just make an analog recording or a recording from the output of the phone, the speaker output. Is it loud enough that you can hear it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's, Don, that's the best thing to do. The sound quality's not that great anyway. You'll be able to make a decent recording. Just, you need a little recorder or your smartphone. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
George isn't at home. Please leave a message at the beep. I must be out, or I pick up the phone. Where could I be? Believe it or not, I'm not home.
George, are you there?
I love it. Leo.
Stupid.
Now, see, how do you say that? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, we're having so much fun in the chat room. 8888 Ask Leo. Lots of good ideas. It's a simple problem. It just shows you the mismatch between the analog world and the digital world. Grandpa has some great recordings, as I think many of us do. I save all those silly, funny voicemail recordings from the kids. He has a Uniden voicemail phone, built-in voicemail phone. Wants to get rid of it, but doesn't dare because on that chip are all these great saved voicemails from the grandkids. Now what? How do we get them into something? Certainly, you could record the output of the speaker, and that's probably the easiest. And certainly, it's going to be completely effective. If you've got a smartphone with a recording device, you could just play back the voicemail messages and record them. If you've got a microphone with a cassette player or cassette recorder, lots of ways to do that. That's the old-fashioned way of doing it. And then I was trying to think of something a little more modern, Google Voice, for instance, and we'll put a link in the show notes to an article that purports to tell you how you can record outbound calls on Google Voice, because there is, there is kind of a nice little loophole here. This Uniden allows you to collect messages, as many answering machines do, from outside, to phone in to the Uniden and get the messages by entering a code. So I thought, well, if he makes a phone call with Google Voice, records the call, then says to the Uniden, play me back all the messages, he'll have all the messages. You certainly can do that with the Google Voice web interface. And that's probably the thing. Set up the Google Voice account, not making the call from a phone, but make it from the computer. Google Voice lets you make phone calls from the computer. You should be able to record the audio on the computer, and that would include not only your side of the conversation, but I think it would record the voicemail side of it, and then you'd have those. So there's a couple of good solutions. I'll put the link to that article in our show notes. You'll find those at techguylabs.com. This is episode 848. 848. techguylabs.com. I like that kind of a challenge. Adam is in Putnam Valley, Nevada. New York. Our next caller. Hi, Adam. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Leo, how you doing? I've called before. You've always been a wonderful help. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Absolutely. My question is this. I use Airport Extreme second generation, the 802.11n. I have a lot of devices on it right now. I guess because of technology. I have over 15 devices at one time sometimes.
Wow.
Number one, is there a limit to how many devices I can have? I looked up on the internet. No one seems to have an answer. Is there a way of slowing it down? Because sometimes it seems like it slows to a crawl. I don't know if that's my internet provider or my Wi-Fi. And number
Okay, go ahead. Keep going. Number two.
And number two is, how can I manage it where if I don't want something on it, where I could block it and keep it from going on? I have a lot of kids in the house, and sometimes I don't want them on the internet.
Right. So, of course, if you've got 15 devices on there and they're all downloading something at the same time, it's going to use up your bandwidth. It's going to use up both the bandwidth from your internet service provider. It could even use up the bandwidth on the router. The router does have a limit. I'm not sure what the actual number of devices, the limit on the number of devices is in the router. There's a practical limit, and there probably is a hard-coded limit. You know, some of these devices, you can only put five guys on there. Some 15, some 50. But the real limit is, you know, how much bandwidth you've got. And I don't mean just internet bandwidth, but bandwidth for the router. So, you know, at some point, the router is just going to say, hey, I can't do it all. And you'll notice that when it slows down. What is nice about the airport, and I think you could use this to answer both your questions, is it does have access control built in. And you'll see you can set up in your airport, and you'll use the airport utility on the Macintosh to do this. Times that the airport can be used for the internet, times it's shut down, and it's per computer. So what you can do is you can set up different controls for each computer in your house. So you could say, you know, you got a 5-year-old, that kid can only use the computer for an hour. The 16-year-old can use it for 8 hours. You can actually have, and you can set the times that they're able to use it and everything. That access control is available. It's in the settings. Just dig around a little bit. You'll see it. And I use it all the time because, you know, we had homework time, right? And the kids would just be on the computer the whole time. So at 9 p.m., I'd turn off the internet, say, guess what? You can't be online. You got to be doing your homework. It's very, very handy.
Right.
That will help you, too, with your limits because you can say, you know, for instance, these devices can only go on at this time, these devices at this time.
Right. Okay.
So that's that. Now, I don't know of a way to say, not built into the router, to say, okay, this device only gets, you know, 1 megabit per second, this device gets 2. You can do that in software. If you're using a proxy server or something like that, but I don't think there's a way to do that in the router. That's pretty sophisticated.
Right. Okay.
Some higher-end routers you can. You know, you go out and get a Cisco business router, you can do that.
Right.
Not an airport extreme.
Okay.
But the good news is you do have access control. Those access control lists are very flexible in the airport. There can be time. It's really fantastic. And if you want even finer control, and I used this as well, OpenDNS.com allows you to have parental control via the router. And this is such a clever idea. You know, all computers need a domain name server, an address book that they can look up addresses before they go out on the internet. Usually your internet service provider provides that, but you can change that address from your internet service provider's address to a third party, in this case, OpenDNS. Let them be the directory. And then OpenDNS has some great solutions for parents, schools, libraries, to control what kind of websites are visible. It's absolutely free. You can pay for a higher-end version, but the free version probably does everything you want. It also has time-based access controls as well as things like preventing kids from going to sites that are adult and so forth. Very, very sophisticated stuff. A lot of schools use OpenDNS. I love it. OpenDNS.com. So between that and your router, I think you should be able to control everything going on your internet. Steven in New Jersey, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Steve. What can I do for you?
I'm an independent journalist, and over the years I've been using Gmail as my primary email service. And in light of the latest privacy concerns, I would really like to wean myself off of it. Now, I was wondering, is there a way I can maybe self-host my email?
Sure.
A way of like maximizing my privacy?
So let's talk a little bit about what Google does and doesn't know about your email. Of course, anybody who hosts your email has the capability of reading it unless that email is encrypted. Whether that's your internet service provider, Yahoo, Google, or Microsoft. And in fact, if a email provider offers spam filtering of any kind, they are reading your email. That's how it works. So, you know, Microsoft made a lot of hay about Google's reading your email. Well, so is Microsoft. They wouldn't be able to do spam filtering if they weren't. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'll talk about how you can make email more private. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Talking to Stephen in New Jersey. He's a journalist, and he's worried that his email is not private. And it's not just Google, Stephen. It's potentially everyone. You understand that, first of all, email goes through many servers. So let's say I send you an email message. Not only does it start at my internet service provider, but then it goes through usually several more servers along the way. That's the way the internet works, is that these servers, and they're randomized fairly well, handle the mail. Now, if your mail is not encrypted, each and every server along the way has the ability to read it. Mm-hmm. And then it lands on Gmail. And Gmail, now, there's not a human reading it. Don't misunderstand. It scans the contents of the message for several things. They scan it for spam. They also scan it for keywords to trigger ads. So if you're talking about phishing, you're more likely to get an ad for people who fish. That is automated. It's not a human. But I understand, if you don't want your email read, even that might be too much. Now, especially now, if you're a journalist and perhaps you have sources you want to protect, things like that, email is not secure, period. In fact, Google Mail may be more secure than your internet service provider's email, because at least with Google, the mail is... the traffic is HTTPS. It's encrypted between you and Google. So those servers along the way actually can't read Gmail, whereas they may very well be able to read other mail as it's transmitted. So there's all sorts of... I take it back, because that's when you're typing your mail. Once it's sent, it still goes unencrypted through servers, so it's still visible. So in other words, there's no such thing as private email through any service unless you take steps to scramble it. That means either encrypting your email as you send and receive it, and there are lots of good solutions for that. You've probably heard of PGP, pretty good privacy. That's widely used, for instance, by dissidents who don't want hostile governments to read their mail. I use a free Canadian service that uses PGP on their back end called Hushmail. It is a web-based email service. But for all I know, the CIA runs Hushmail. I mean, it's very hard to know. It claims to be secure. But for all I know, it's the Canadian government. I don't know who runs. You understand the issue? We can't really be sure it's secure.
Yeah, and I don't engage in any sensitive correspondence through email, but I just like to let my sources be rest assured that sure. I am taking every step possible to make sure that,
absolutely.
They get
absolutely.
Out or leak.
If you really, you said, look, this is really hot stuff. This is sensitive. If you're Bradley Manning sending stuff to WikiLeaks, you should be using a desktop encryption program like PGP. I use GNU Privacy Guard. It's GPG. It's free and it works on most platforms. The way that works is you will have to exchange a key with your correspondent. That can be handled fairly automatically. There are key servers, for instance, that hold people's keys. They can look up. They can say, I want to send an email to Stephen. I want it to be private. Let me look up Stephen's key. They get your public key. They encrypt it. No one but you can read that message anywhere along the way. If you want that kind of protection, it's doable, but it requires some effort on your part and some understanding on the part of your correspondents about how to do it.
Yeah.
So, in other words, it's a lot of work. For a long time, I signed every message I sent out. I encrypted every message I could because I wanted to promote the idea of everybody using encryption purely for privacy. Because the real problem right now is if you encrypt your email, it's a red flag saying, I got something to hide. And so you might be attracting undue attention simply by using encrypted email. Bottom line, Google Mail, Gmail, is no worse than anything else. In some ways, it's better than others. But all email has this fundamental flaw, which is It's like sending a postcard. It can be. I don't think it is, but it could be read by anybody along the way.
All right.
So if you never treat email as a secure communication, ever.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. That's the bottom line. And it comes back to what I said when I was talking about at the very beginning of the show. If you're putting it on the internet, you're putting it in public. Unless you really know what you're doing and you know how to use strong encryption, the people on the other end know how to use strong encryption, then you can have some certainty that it's secure. EFF, thank you. Cool Breeze in our chat room has given me a link to an EFF page upon EFF is a great company, a great group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They're a nonprofit fighting for freedom on the internet. They have a page called Surveillance Self-Defense, and they talk about a lot of different privacy issues, including email, and how email is at risk and what to do about it. That's a great page. I highly recommend it. It's a long URL. It's basically ssd.eff.org for Surveillance Self-Defense, and then you can go to the email section and read up on that. But there's other things: foreign intelligence, terrorism, defense technology, instant messaging, Wi-Fi, all of the different potential security flaws. This would be good, Stephen, if you, and I understand as a journalist, you do want to protect sources. You do want to protect privacy. Doctors and lawyers have the same issue. It's so funny. I get email from lawyers all the time. You've seen that long boilerplate paragraph they tend to put on the bottom. This is a private communication. If you receive this in error, you're required to delete it immediately. Has no legal value, no legal force, completely silly. Please understand, email is not private, period. And if you want privacy, you're going to need to take some additional steps. Go a little bit farther along the road, like, for instance, encryption. If I exchange email with you, most of the time my email is signed using a GNU privacy card. That's a certificate, I think, depending on the email program I'm using. I do that so that I can't be spoofed. If you receive an email from me that is not signed, there's no guarantee I sent it. But if it's signed and you can go out to these servers and verify the signature, then you know it came from me. It turns out that in getting my signature, you're also getting my public key, which means at that point you can send me encrypted emails, private emails. And if you include a signature with your email that includes your public key, I can send you private emails. So the mechanism is not very complicated. It takes no more than an exchange of email back and forth to set up a completely private, encrypted email system between two parties. It's utterly secure. But nobody uses it. Nobody understands it. And it does require, some sophistication on the part of your correspondents. So as every once in a while, I get an encrypted email. But very rarely. Very rarely. Mike in White Oak, Texas. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hey, Mike.
Thank you for taking this call.
Thanks for calling.
I really enjoy the information you put out, and it's really been helpful for me in a lot of various activities.
Thank you.
And I've got a question for you dealing with my parents. They're 90 years old, and I monitor them a lot of times from my computer with Skype. They sit in front of a TV all day.
Oh, that's great. So you have a computer at their end that's got Skype on, and you can watch them.
I can watch them, look in on them, check on them. And so I've got it set up right next to their TV.
That's brilliant. Did you set it up so that when Skype auto answers and auto sends video, so you just call that Skype number and suddenly you're seeing them?
Exactly.
Brilliant.
So I can, with my iPad, I can call them from any location that I have Wi-Fi.
What a great idea.
And check in on them. And the situation, what I have is my dad.
Mike, hold on, because we got to take a break, and I will get your question. But we're going to take a break and come back. Our last segment, believe it or not. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Stay tuned. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Talking with Stephen, who has a very clever idea. He set up a Skype computer with a camera, put a Skype account on it. It's looking at his parents. And anytime he calls into it from any Skype account, it automatically answers, turns on video. He can look in on them, see how they're doing. What a great idea. So what can I do to help you? Hello? Oh, Stephen. Did we lose him? Stephen, are you there? Oh, nuts.
I don't hear him.
I think he got out of the car. I'll tell you what, I'll put him on hold because I do hear car noise. We'll put him on hold and we'll see if we can get him back in a minute. Ernest in Littleton, Colorado. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Ernest.
Hey, Leo.
How are you?
Yes.
Actually, I'm the president, according to Jason Heiner at Tech Republic. We had an election, you know.
Yeah, I've been listening since the very first podcast of Twit.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you listened. Yeah. I appreciate it.
I had a question. Like, I started a webpage. I'm a siding contractor in Littleton, and I started a webpage on Squarespace, and I always listen to your show, and you say content to get like better
right
organic search.
Right. I mean, you can create a website that is a brochure, but you don't expect a lot of new people to come back. I mean, new people come because they want to know more about your business, but they'll never return. You know, they've got the brochure; they don't need it again.
But, yeah. Well, my question is like, I just wanted to know what I can do as far as like get better results for Google. So like if somebody searches for siding in Littleton,
there you go.
I can come up because like right now I don't come up at all, and like I put a lot of content, I put videos and a lot of stuff like you say too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know.
So let me explain how Google works. This might help you understanding how you can get better ranking. Google ranks you higher when more people link to you. And the higher quality the site is, the more juice it gives you. We call it Google juice. So you get Google juice by getting highly ranked sites to link to you. Now, if nobody's linking to you, you're not going to show up, period, in any search. So... And by the way, if you go to google.com/webmasters, I mentioned those webmaster tools. Those are really useful for understanding how Google works and what you can do, and even seeing how people find you. Because one of the things you want to know is, well, when people do search for me, what terms are they using to search for? There isn't anything magical that you can put hidden away. Sometimes people used to say, oh, yeah, what you need is those, you got to put some meta tags in there. They say citing. No. That's Google's not fooled by that. That's trying to game Google. Remember, what Google's goal is to give its users search results that are the most useful to them. So it's Google's trying to figure out, well, if somebody searches for siding in Littleton, how do I give them the results they want? And Ernest, you're one of the results they want, for sure. If I search for siding in Littleton, I'd like to see every siding contractor in Littleton. You should be in those results. So make it easy for Google. Make sure that you have content on the web page that matches the stuff people would search for you for. Have information about siding, your prices, your location. All that stuff is helpful. Google Places is something to keep in mind. Google allows you to have a free business directory listing on Google Places. Search for yourself on Google Places. If you're not there, create a listing and enhance it. Put everything in there you can. That's a signal. Remember, we're trying to give Google signals about ourselves so that it can do a better job. And the best thing to do if you want to raise yourself in the rankings, you know, you should show up in any search for siding in Littleton. The question is, do you show up first or 15th? If you want now, so you can do some things to get on that list, like having a Google Places listing. But to get yourself higher up on the list, there's only one thing you can do, and that's to get people to link to you. Exchange links maybe with other contractors in the area. I'm sure there's people you do business with, contractors who call you when there's a job to be done. Make sure that you are linked on their page so that whatever Google juice they have also accrues to you. It's things like that. You are doing the right thing by putting more content there. That's great. But you also need to make sure that Google can find you.
Yeah, I started the Google Places.
Good.
And where, you know, when you
That means you'll show up in local search. So if somebody's in Littleton searching for siding, Google knows where they are. You will show up as a result. If you look on the Google results, you'll see at the top there those little red pins. Those are all Google Places listings.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Yeah, like if you search for siding now, like where I'm at, you get search results from like contractors in different states.
Yeah, that's not right. We don't want that. That's another reason, by the way, Google has done all this personalization stuff. They're starting to do more localization stuff. You know, I feel your pain. You're not alone. Everybody feels this way. Everybody wants to improve their search rankings. And it's not always feasible to get people to link to you. So you got to do what you can. Read the Webmaster Tools, google.com/webmasters. And just do what you can and just cross your fingers. And it's kind of, that's how it kind of is. It's not like the Yellow Pages where you can buy a listing. It's not, I wish it were that easy. I love the setup you had for your folks. What can I do to help you now?
No, this wasn't that. I'm not the same Steven.
Oh, that's a different Steven. All right. What can I do for you, Steven?
Okay. I have a problem with my computer. I lost my IP address.
You lost it?
Yeah, I don't know where it went. I had Comcast come over and evaluate the computer, and they hooked their computer up, and they could get on the internet from my service point or my cable point.
So it's your computer's settings are wrong. You always have an IP address. There's the public IP address, which is what Comcast gave you. That's a single address. That is what is seen by the public. And then each computer within the router, and I presume you have a router, has its own address. You should have a router. Comcast probably gave you one. If they didn't, go out and get one. That's a good security system. And then set your network settings to automatically set IP address, Windows or Mac. Just let the router assign you addresses. On the Mac with airports, it's usually a 10.0.something address. On Windows and Linksys and so forth, usually 192.168.something.something address. That's your local IP address. Yes, you do need that. It's not that it lost its IP address. It lost its settings for the internet. So you just need to work your way through those again and get them to work. Now I got Mike. I'm sorry, Mike. There you are, Mike, in White Oak, Texas. Got you back. Hi, Mike. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
All right, great. I've got my parents, and I'm Skyping them, automatically. But they can't, they're not able to get up and do anything on the computer. So what I'm wanting to do is interact through their TV, kind of interrupt their broadcast and put my own Skype on there, perhaps. Or
you want to say, hey, Mom, hey, Dad, it's me. It's Mike.
Yeah, exactly.
How could you do that on the TV? That's an interesting question.
And I've heard you talk about Slingbox and that it allows you to kind of remote control your home TV.
But you can't put an image of yourself on the TV yet. Okay. Wow, that's a good question. And unfortunately, we're running out of time. Let me think about that, Mike. Maybe I'll have an answer for you by next week. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.